This is CliffCentral.com.
Sanbonani Nonke, welcome to the show. It is, frankly speaking, another hour of hot potato issues in South Africa. Yo, I am excited. I am excited for this show, not only because of the show itself, you know, we're going to be fighting consultants, but also because Rorisang Shabalala is back in studio. Rorisang, Dumelang.
What's up, brother?
Legay.
Sharp, was it?
Yeah, right. When's that, man?
Just this and that, here and there.
Pumula ne ipitolia, what's happening there?
I didn't pumula anything. There's no pumulering. I'm very tired.
From what? We want to know where you were. All these headlines about Gupta's, KPMG, McKinsey, and you disappeared throughout all of them. So now we are wondering, where were you?
You know what I found very interesting about our show, a lovely show, is how you get captains of industry when I leave. Coleman, managing director of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, you know.
And they won't come when I am here.
Because they're scared of you. They're not scared of me. They call me the lame duck of the
two.
No,
this is collusion. This is just
white monopoly capital
colluding with one another. Listen, so that the tough questions aren't asked.
I would totally disagree with you, but I'm not going to disagree with you.
And now we have a black consulting firm, and now I've been brought in to try and grow my own people. Exactly. It will not happen.
Exactly. You know what you are?
Yeah.
How are you doing, Rory?
I'm good, homie. How are you doing?
Good, man. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's another hour of this. We've just seen some very interesting things happen. We spoke to Colin Coleman about 2 weeks back around what should big business do. He gave some very interesting discussion points. I think he missed a few of the questions. You know, he ducked and dived like a brilliantly media-trained person.
He's properly media-trained.
No, he's properly media-trained. It was very interesting to be in his office, in his executive suite with his cufflinks on and me hitting him up with some questions, but he handled them very well. We did miss you during that interview. And now we see McKinsey coming around full circle, which is very interesting because we know a few McKinsey people, don't we? I mean, let's just put it on the cards. We do. We know a few.
Oh, you do?
No. When I said we, I said, you know, it's...
You know what fascinates me about this McKinsey thing? To be honest, I've been very...
what fascinates you?
No, I've been very intrigued by how you've been riled up by it. I mean, I've been following the story and so on, but... I mean, you are baying for blood, particularly when it comes to McKinsey and KPMG. What's going on inside of you?
All right, here's the truth. You know, I once went for an interview at McKinsey and they bounced. No, I'm joking. I think it's good. We need to put our spaces and our places, you know, where we sit on this table, you know. I think that I find very little value in managing consulting firms. Just the nature of them, the way in which they've been structured. I think they have drained the intellectual capacity of our young South Africans because it's very nice to be seen as part of the McKinsey, Bain, BCG group. Do they add any value? Do they add any real value?
So you don't think consultants add value?
I think they add value to the corporate. But how much value, besides the profit line item, I'm not so sure. And that's what I worry about. So I hate the whole system. I hate the way it is very unhuman-centric. I hate the way it's very unempathetic towards people. That's where I stand. You will then correct me because, of course, you're a consultant and the man next to me here is a consultant. So you see, I can't even look in the eyes.
Don't put me in a box.
I'll put you in every box. So we're going to be speaking about this whole thing and I suppose taking it a bit further, zooming out a little bit in the South African context is, you know, how do we do good business in South Africa when profit is really the underlying theme? How do we not get into these dodgy situations with dodgy people offering big amounts? I mean, you know, it's all good for me to scream the odds outside. But when I'm in the ring and someone offers me 1.1 billion or 800 million like they offered Jonas, I mean...
Well, or you're
going to take that.
Or you're offered money by a big bank that doesn't exactly follow the right ethical, and it funds the work that you do.
100%.
Do you turn it back?
The means, the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does it justify? Absolutely agree. Those are your views, not mine. Just in case that ever comes back. All right. So we're speaking about all of this. Frankly speaking, do good people come last?
Good guys don't
so
come
what?
With. Frankly speaking, to good guys come last in business.
Why do you want to be sexist like that? Why does it have to always be
men? It's not sexist. You know, the term is called good guys.
Because it was a sexist society.
Who decided that guys must refer to men?
Yeah?
Who decided that guys must refer to men? You see, you are your patriarchal mindset.
So guys does not...
It can refer to anyone.
Refer to men.
It can refer... Why can't women claim that?
All right. www.urbandictionary.com. Guys... Okay, why are we doing this?
But that Urban Dictionary was written by a man, and so he decided to claim that cool word as a male word.
Thank you.
We're reclaiming it. It's a woman's word.
Who are we? You are a male.
Good guys... Frankly speaking, do good guys come last?
And this is why, when you haven't seen your radio partner for a while, you must at least extend the show by an hour. Because our guest, Derek Thomas from Letsema Consulting and Investment Firms, hasn't said one word. I mean, that's a bit disrespectful.
Well, let's get the show on the road. But before we do that, if anyone wants to jump in on the conversation, you're welcome to send in your comments on Twitter at @Yebo_Levy or at Rory Shabalala. Please send us your opinions, and if there's any that we think could add to the conversation, by all means, you can either catch us on our Facebook page where the conversation continues nonstop.
The amount of notifications we get on that thing.
Absolutely. So,
and from you know what's beautiful about that Facebook page, just as an aside, the comments are from such a diverse range of listeners. That's what I love about it.
Absolutely.
So thank you to everyone who listens and who partakes and participates in all of the conversations. Very nice.
Alternatively, send us hate mail on Twitter.
that's you. I never get hate mail.
Now, ever since we stopped, ever since we no longer do that many shows on racism, I think we're cool.
And white privilege. No one sends us things.
No one sends us the hate mail.
Mr. Thomas, hello to you. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. Can I start with a confession? I've never listened to your radio show.
Well, that's... I mean, now you've started...
That's
very
fantastic.
You've started very badly, because I've hated you already, and now you're really going to...
Finish him!
And now you're
like... Mortal
Kombat. You know,
finish him!
So, we must be honest. We do know Derek from another way. I know him personally. You know him as well.
Well done.
So, but today we're going to be open and honest. Derek, I'm laying it out there. You've heard how we've introduced it. You see how Rory's already got me riled up about men and women and feminism, sexism, and all sorts.
And consulting.
So you at least know where I stand. I will try to be as biased as possible and make sure that I ask all the hard questions about consulting.
Well, I'm really keen to get into the consulting thing, because I really don't get where you're coming from with all of that.
Let's start with
the story. I think a lot of people, just to give some context, so there's this big story that's happening right now around Eskom and how consultants have basically creamed off tons of money off Eskom in some corrupt ways. McKinsey and Trillion are at the heart of this issue, and basically were paid over 1 billion rand for consulting services, and were due to receive another 9.4 billion rand for their consulting services. Now there's a big thing about the work that they did. Was it worth a billion? And Trillion, who were the BE partners to McKinsey in all of the setup, what did they do to earn that much money? And so we have this entire cloud hanging over the consulting as an industry now. And just generally looking at how this entire situation has unfolded, and you see that the involvement of the likes of KPMG, SAP, and so on, is, you know, do good guys finish last when it comes to business? Is there a way of succeeding? I mean, if the likes of KPMG, McKinsey, SAP, big companies, are relying on what seems like shady dealings to get ahead, what hope is there for any of us that are trying to do things the right way? Of course, we've got Letsema Consulting represented here, and where they fit into the story, Andrew, is that they were McKinsey's BE partner on this deal initially, and then, as the story goes, they were shoved out of the way in order to accept a Gupta-backed Trillion. Letsema wasn't going to serve the purpose for the Gupta mission, and so they had to be shoved aside, and we need to find out if that's true. They were shoved aside, Trillion was brought in, and so the Guptas then were able to hive off a lot of money.
Rory Song, I want to correct you on one issue.
Yes.
We were McKinsey's so-called BEE partner from about 2005 to about 2010. So I just want to correct you on your phrase on this deal. We were never their partner on quote, this you were their deal, BEE partner unquote.
In general. Across different projects and so on.
And it was, to me, a value-adding partnership.
Yeah.
They were good to us. We learned a lot of IP. We were exposed to a lot of great consulting assignments, just to put the record straight.
So just by the way, on Letsema, you are the CEO of Letsema. Letsema is a 20-year-old, the oldest black management consulting firm?
I believe we're the oldest black management consulting firm. We were established in 1996. Our founder is Isaac Shongwe, who, to the best of my knowledge, is the second black Rhodes Scholar ever to have been produced by South Africa. And for those of you who enjoy football, scored the winning goal for Oxford against Cambridge.
So,
he's quick on his feet.
He might need to be in the future as well. Right, so let's talk here quickly. Why in heaven's name would McKinsey need a BEE partner?
Well, I think it became a de facto business practice in South Africa in line with our national priorities, right?
Black facing.
Pardon?
Like the idea of facing with black people to show that they are transformed when actually they're not, and it's just an easy way to give a company like McKinsey access to big deals.
I'm asking the big questions.
Andrews is exposing his cards a little bit too soon.
I'm asking
questions. This is back in the 90s. We needed we needed to build black businesses, and so it was how do you do skills transfer? You get the black businesses to partner with established businesses and to deliver on projects and over time gain the skills so that they can do it themselves.
Done sincerely.
Mm-hmm.
These partnerships between established and nascent, between black and white, between large and small, can be very productive for an economy.
Totally can see that. Derek, you've given some of the credentials of your partner, Isaac. You are an economist by trade. There's no shortage of intellectual property between the two of you, and I'm sure the people that you have in your company. So I can see that. So I'm just trying to understand, like, McKinsey's this big multinational corporation, and, you know, it's very easy to just talk the good game of the day, right? And the good game of the day was transformation. The good game of the day was to build black businesses. But truthfully, I mean, they needed you in order to get the government deals, right?
So those are the practices that got established in this country in line with national economic policy. McKinsey, Letsema, countless other firms were doing so in compliance with laudable goals.
Okay. No, we'll park that one there for a second. You know what the problem is? There's a good side, of course. BEE was set up for perfect good intentions, right? Absolutely. There's no way in my mind that I'll doubt that.
BEE offers a number of advantages. It's absolutely not without agreed. Its cynical side, but it offers a number of advantages. You could have cost reduction. So a South African firm with a lower cost base than these global majors. How about the symbolic value of showing to up-and-coming black professionals that it can be done if it's done correctly? There are a number of benefits to the process.
Let's then ask the question a different way before we get back into the topic. Do you think that BEE has been done correctly in South Africa? Because we're talking about business and we're asking you, of course, it is difficult for you to hold all these questions, but as a leader in South Africa of one of the great businesses.
Thank you. So BEE is a small acronym that means a whole lot of things in a whole lot of contexts. It covers procurement, affirmative action, supplier development, and the truth be told, it depends on who the beneficiaries are and their stated intentions or their intentions more broadly and who's handing out the privileged position.
All right, so in this case now, let's bring it back. Rory, we were speaking about this trillion deal, 1.6 billion in consulting fees. Let's just talk about the number before we get onto anything else. That sounds ridiculous as a consulting fee number for professional services. Am I just out to lunch because I don't know about this? Is this standard practice to be charging R1 billion for a project of this nature?
I've been in consulting for 23 years. I have not seen numbers like this. It's off the radar.
So what are they likely doing to, I mean, if you put R1 billion on an invoice, what have you been doing during that period?
That's a great question.
If you haven't seen, if you haven't seen those numbers, then you've been exposed to consulting for 20 years, what could you possibly do to justify putting R1 billion on an invoice?
So ordinarily, what's a consulting assignment? It's the number of people, number of professionals deployed over time. So day, hours, days, weeks, months, multiplied by a rate proportional to their seniority and the brand value of the firm they represent. Mm. So to arrive at a number like R1 billion, you would have to have an army of consultants, in my opinion. Mm. However, as I understand this particular contract, it was based on a risk-based savings formula, which is a variation, a conceptual variation on how consultants normally charge.
Mm. So just explain this risk-based variation.
Sure. So as I understand, what was being contemplated here was, dear client, we'll save you R1 billion. Consequently, we'll be entitled to a proportion of that.
Mm. So is that so wrong? So basically what you're doing is you're putting your fees at risk and you're saying, if we don't produce those savings, we don't get paid. But if we get paid, there's an upside. So should South Africans be looking at this number and saying, you know, it's ridiculous, or simply say, well, they did put their fees at risk? Where is the issue then? Because there seems to be a huge issue about the amount. Where is the particular issue with the amount?
Well, I mean, the conceptual model is a legitimate one.
Mm.
Let's start there. So if you can demonstrate either a savings-based delta or a revenue-based delta, a professional services provider, a consulting firm, should be able to contemplate such a conceptual model.
Mm.
I don't know the details of this particular engagement. I think it was savings-based, and I don't know. I haven't seen any argument either for or to the contrary suggesting that the number was out of sync.
Mm.
So if you've just joined us, we're speaking today, frankly speaking, do good people or good guys, as Rory wants to claim it, come last in the business sense in South Africa, speaking to the CEO of Letsema Holdings, Derek Thomas. And Derek, I'm just interested, you spoke about how, or we clarified how you were McKinsey's BE partner and then you got kicked to the curb. Is that right? Were you kicked to the curb, or was it thanks for coming but no thanks, and then got replaced by Trillion? Or just help me out with a little bit of the...
Well, back in about 2010, we slowly but surely stopped... tendering for work together and going to market together. It was later explained to me that we had, quote, graduated, unquote, from their supplier development program. I can't speak to the veracity of that claim. I can just say that at the time it was painful for a firm that had in many ways been consumed by the embrace of McKinsey. And as I previously stated, it was a great space to be commercially. And then you feel the cold winds of a commercial world without a large partner. So you've used the phrase kick to the curb. In many ways, and irony is the strongest force in the universe, I'm grateful for that, because it's meant that we've had to grow up as a firm.
So just you speak of graduating from, what does that mean? You no longer fitted with the profile of what a supplier is. What does that look like?
Well, as I think the phrase was a reference to if you like, a process of maturation and then an event, which is to say, hey, Letsema, we incubated you over a period of, let's say, 5 years, and now you are post incubation. You've graduated. Mm. You've passed matric. You've got your degree.
But it certainly sounds like matric was imposed on you. from the story, it wasn't a thing that on this date we agree that you guys are graduating or at this point. It seems as if one day they knocked on your door and they said, hey, we didn't realize this, but you guys have graduated. Cheers.
Well, I'll leave it to you, Rory, to make up your own mind on that one.
Well, but the stories are suggesting that, you know, it almost, this was unexpected in a way. This replacement by Trillion was kind of unexpected. Is that, are we understanding the story correctly?
That's correct.
Right, so
just before we move on there, like this must be a really interesting space for you to be in. You're seeing the headlines. You've worked intimately, as you talked about, the warm embrace of McKinsey. Is it a surprise to you, knowing the characters within the McKinsey walls, knowing those senior partners, understanding their personalities, their archetypes? Is this a surprise to you that this came out?
McKinsey are very good at what they do. Make no mistake about that. As are the peer group of quality tier one consulting firms, global consulting firms. They are, and I hope they don't mind me saying so, commercially aggressive, commercially astute, hungry for business, and they are mature in how they go after business as a general rule. And yeah, I'm talking about globally.
Mm.
Answer the question further, Derek. Are you surprised by the people, you know, given that you know the people intimately, are you surprised that a deal like this came about? Or do you think that this was always on the cards, and because you were in the intimate embrace, sometimes you have to look, you know, you don't see it clearly? And again, this is no fault of yours. We're not implicating you in anything. I'm just saying, because you're in that warm embrace, it's hard to see, but actually the character flaws of the individuals, the culture of the company, what did you say, commercially aggressive, then makes sense for this to happen.
Look, it happened. So you're always looking with a lens of trying to understand within the context of a post-fact world. So it's hard for me to place myself in a 2010 environment and answer that question honestly. Mm. Perhaps I would put it this way. In a world where you have very clever people with aggressive commercial targets, something like this could happen and did happen.
So you speak about McKinsey being very, you know, professionally astute and so on. There you are. You've had 5 years of McKinsey incubation, as you put it. And then you get replaced by Trillion, sort of a startup by the sounds of things. I mean, one imagines that if you were the number one black consulting firm, there was a number two. So the number two, number three, number four were ignored and overlooked for a startup called Trillion. How does that factor in? I mean, a person who's looking at this and making sense of it, is that rational, just looking at it, I mean, as an outsider? Or is there something dodgy? Because, again, we're reading the story and we're like, okay, so is there something wrong with the fact that Trillion were brought in? Don't credentials, you said credentials were an important thing.
Sure. So
they had none.
So to partner with a sophisticated tier one global consulting firm, you need to have a level of sophistication, built-in investments, skills, balance sheet, financial resources, strategic intent, alignment of goals. So my response to your question is, you would expect indeed if you're going, and no one's entitled to be in partnership with McKinsey, right? That's not the argument I'm making. But you would be surprised that if you're not going to be occupying that position anymore, as was the case with Letsema, that indeed number two or three or four on the list would assume that position. What I'm beginning to appreciate in the fullness of time is that I guess market access is much more important than any of the other criteria.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the ability to close the deal.
I think that leads us actually into this entire conversation of do good guys, and yes, guys finish last in business.
We're going to fight about this the whole show.
In the sense that it seems that, I mean, particularly the state-owned enterprises, market access really is driven by political connection. So a guy that's just trying to do his work as best as possible, even that is not good enough. It certainly wasn't good enough, it seems, for Letsema. So is there a way of navigating? I mean, one imagines that, you know, myself as someone with a bit of insight into that world, that most black consulting firms rely primarily on government and state-owned entities for most of their business. And then one imagines that if you don't have access to that business, it's then very difficult to make it. So is there any other way than to sign a deal with a devil like Trillion, who've got market access, if you're going to then succeed?
Look, the state has a duty of care. What are they presiding over? They are presiding over the nation's fiscal resources. And whether that's in Eskom, any other SOC or SOE or government department, that means their duty of care, in my opinion, is to match their spending with the nation's priorities. So, for example, local value addition, black firms, small firms, all of these need to be given expression to with the value of that money. So that means those powerful positions need to be occupied by officers who care, who can demonstrate competency in execution of that mandate. Mm. Value for money and alignment with the nation's priorities. Mm. It's a simple equation. And then you layer that with who guards the guardians, who looks at their work. And there you have positions like the chief procurement officer at National Treasury, the Department of Public Enterprises, as the shareholder ministry, and so forth and so on.
And so was there a failure in that particular role then? Because, again, you speak about market access being the key thing. It doesn't matter how smart you are, how much of a balance sheet you have, market access. And market access is not a function, unfortunately, of how long you've been in the game for, it seems. So the idea that to the extent that the Guptas are market access to government contracts across the board, whether in consulting or anything else, is there a way of making it without then signing a deal with the Gupta? I mean, even KPMG did it, which is also quite weird.
I think what we're seeing is a distorting gravitational force. It's so large, it's so distorting, that it disrupts the rules of a fair game. Everyone should be entitled to pitch for a piece of work if it's properly advertised and provided you have the credentials that are appropriate to the task being requested. Mm. And that it is done in an open and transparent and value for money based fashion. Mm. What I think we're seeing with this protracted episode in our nation's history is a gravitational pull away from a fair set of rules. A developmental set of rules.
Given that, how did you guys do it? So you were kicked to the curb, to use that phrase, and you still had to try and survive and to compete, and you're still around, yes, and you're still kicking ass and so on. How did you do it? And what does that say about? I mean, there are many others who are listening who are saying, so what does this mean for us? Is there a way? I mean, there's some of us who will not do business with government because it's just too risky, not worth it, and so on. That means you're cutting a huge part of your market, particularly as black business, out. And now you have to play within private sector. And, I mean, there's another injustice in South Africa is that you can't get work in private sector because you don't have market access either. So is there hope for anyone that wants to play the game fair to succeed? Or do the good guys finish last?
Look, you're raising a number of important points. The first thing is, I think if there's a distortion of the rules of the game, in the way that we're seeing, what's going to happen is businesses are going to move away from serving the state as part of their strategy. So the second round effect of that is that the state will suffer adverse selection. The weaker players will pitch up to serve the state, and the state will suffer as a consequence of that weaker advice, inputs, or the lack thereof, so that we don't have, say, domestic value addition to serve the state in manufacturing, whatever case may, the case may be. Excuse me. How did we survive this? Well, struggling a little bit every day. I guess we had been in business for a long time. We had built up some financial resources that could buffer us. We also had the skills to pivot to other customers. And in my person and that of Isaac, I think we had shareholders who were patient enough to say, we are of strategic intent to build a beautiful black consulting firm, and that this period would be a temporary hiccup. So we suspended dividends, salary increases to myself, bonuses to me and the senior execs to survive this period. But I can tell you it's tough.
Derek, let's talk a little bit about the state-owned enterprises that you're speaking about. What value do consultants add? I mean, surely, you know, we've got Eskom, we saw SAA, you know. SAA has literally hired consultancy firm after consultancy firm to try and get them out of this backlog of debt and mismanagement. What value are they adding? I mean, at the moment, let's just talk SAA. SAA, in numbers, could have bought Emirates. How incredibly crazy is that?
What, from consulting, Emirates from Airlines, the money that it paid?
The bailout money
that
South Africa has bailed them out on. Mm. They could have bought Emirates Airline. Mm. I mean, let's do that. Mm. Let's do that instead of
what, and complicate our issues and have to deal with a bigger fleet when we can't manage
Emirates,
the one we
maybe
have.
There'll be something that comes along with it, you know. But what value do consultants add?
Consultants are not a panacea for the world's ills. They're just not. What they are is a service provider that, if you used carefully, could be value-adding, whether that's in revenue generation or cost savings or deciding whether you're going to enter new markets or not, making up for temporary staff shortages, introducing new intellectual capital, new ways of doing things. There are a myriad of ways that you can deploy consultants, as is the case with any other professional services provider. Here's the point, though, and this is at the heart of the point of the challenge. A consulting firm and a consulting assignment, in my view, is only as good as the client procuring the service. So that you need this dynamic between good consultant and good client. If either of them is out of sync, you won't have a good outcome.
Derek?
There's a whole... Consulting is getting a beat down at the moment. And in the latest Financial Mail, there's a whole thing around Standard Bank's use of McKinsey and consulting as well. And the big question that's being asked there is, but these companies should have... I mean, the guys running these companies should be experts in what they do. Why in the world are you bringing in external parties to advise you on strategy when actually aren't you hired to develop strategy anyway? How does that, just adding to Andrew's point, is it not a duplication? Is this not a failure? When a person engages a consultant, are they conceding to the fact that they don't know their stuff?
Well, when you go and see a ophthalmologist, are you conceding to the fact that you don't know your own eyes?
Well, yes. Only if I don't have an ophthalmologist in-house, right, doing the job. Like, this is the thing, right? You've spoken a little bit about what consultants can do. And I think this is a very difficult conversation to have because you've been in this business for so long. So if someone came to me and said, what added value does an NGO create, right? Like Rory did in our show in 2016.
Oh, is this what this is about?
So it's very hard for me to say, No, we actually, you're right, Rory, we don't add any value, right? But here's my interesting thing. I think consultants do add value, but what value are they adding? Like, what is their definition of value? And you've put it in this terms, revenue generation, cost saving,
going into new markets or not, right? As a bucket list of some of the things.
Some of the things.
100% right. And I'll concede to that. Of course, there's more, right? Yeah. But those all seem like profit generation or cost-saving activities. When, specifically when you talk about state-owned enterprises, right? And SOCs who are supposed to be serving the country in some way or form, right? How do we add value to the humans in the system? How do manager consultants add value to the humans in the systems that they create?
Let me give you an example from early on in my career.
Cool.
The client was Metro Rail. Today, I think we call them PRASA. Running a service which takes township dwellers to and from work.
Mm-hmm.
Designed to serve an apartheid logic, right? Separate spatial areas. Now, the quality of that train service matters. For example, in particular, the train schedule. When do you put on a train and when don't you? In a world where resources aren't infinite. And I didn't do this, but a colleague of mine did. And I watched how he designed a train service schedule that was more in line with the needs of the commuting public.
Mm.
That's a huge value add. That means somebody's getting to and from work and to and from their family safely and on time.
And more efficiently.
Now, this particular professional had international experience at the time. He had done it globally. And so he was introducing new ways of planning those schedules. And for me, it was a source of great pride to see an international consultant who I was working closely with do these new train schedules to overcome an apartheid spatial legacy.
Isn't there one, and I love that example because I think it's a beautiful one, Derek.
Thank you.
My one question is, don't we get confused in a way? I mean, that example is amazing because I could imagine a state-owned management consulting firm that actually isn't judged by profit that they make or incentivized by profit that they make, but incentivized about human value and making South Africans' lives better, right? But isn't the problem and the crux that consulting firms at the end are basically for-profit enterprises that need to make money on this?
I can tell you of a state-owned electricity provider that is doing amazing in its objectives of supplying electricity. They're not profit driven, aren't they doing amazingly, Andrew?
But
and I could tell you of a state-owned I could tell you of a state-owned logistics company that is supposed to be making sure that our logistics costs make our products and the movement of our products cost effective. Aren't they doing an amazing job?
But here's my
thing. I'm getting between the two of you.
It's such fun. But slow down now. Are we saying that all evil resides in the profit motive?
I'm saying that, unfortunately, because the profit motive exists, that there will always be ways in which you need to not only solve human problems like the PRASA example you gave right now, but embed yourself to make sure that you continuously exist and survive and thrive.
If I can become a guest and answer these questions.
Now, just why are you a guest?
I'm just confused by this thing. And this is a perennial, just to bring Derek into the conversation and our listeners on why we fight over this. Mm. Andrew believes he's not a capitalist, but he benefits from capital.
I've never said that.
I don't understand this entire argument of, so if your objective is profit, therefore, your intentions must be evil. No.
No, that's not what I said.
And in fact,
that's not what I said. Very carefully.
In fact, no less a scholar and thinker than Marx attributed to capitalism and to capitalists the moniker of most productive social class ever in the history of humanity. So that the profit motive, which defines capitalism, at least in part, is a great source of innovation and social good.
Maybe let's turn this on Andrew. Andrew, can you just come clean on what your issue is You alluded to it at the beginning with consultants and so on, and they really get up. They really irritate you. What exactly is your issue? So this profit thing and so on is you trying to elegantly put your disdain. What is it exactly?
I think that, well, we're going a little bit off course here, to be honest and fair. But I think that the issue is around what drives people and how consultants that I've been in touch with are driven. And I think what happens is because of the way in which they're driven, because of their margins, because of the way in which the work is concluded, i.e. I need to finish this work in a number of hours, you know, blah, blah, blah. It creates a whole system of people that are unempathetic, that cannot get emotions in the way because of the work culture / work imperatives that need to be created and actually delivered on. And then what happens is we just lose focus of what we're actually doing. So when we start a project, we might even start with, hey, what is the problem and how can we solve it and how can we help you? But it very quickly turns into how many number of professionals, number of time and seniority of people can we put into this business so that we can continue to thrive? And that's what it comes down to.
That's not an indictment of the profit motive. Neither is it an indictment of consulting. It's an indictment of business practices that should be avoided within the consulting industry, within business in general. Aim for sustainability, aim for moral business models, aim to be contextually developmental, contextually relevant, aim for gentleness in your commercial model.
So, I mean, it still brings us back to that question that we've asked, and you haven't given us a straight answer, Derek. Do good guys finish last in business?
So, no.
Give us an example of a good guy that hasn't finished last.
Donald Trump, eh?
rather than an example, I think what we're going to see as a consequence of some of these aberrant practices is more vigilance in the way procurement happens, both by the private sector and the public sector, quite frankly, in South Africa. I think we're going to see greater vigilance in how empowerment partnerships are struck up. I think the so-called good guys will seek out other good guys. I believe that the credibility of brands will come to the fore again. And some of this distorting influence I made reference to will disappear because of what we've seen and the disgust that South Africans have laid at the door of these business practices.
But what do you say then about this ongoing need for black firms, service providers, etc., to rely on government and SOEs? What is that saying about the state of inclusivity within the private sector and the fact that it seems, I mean, from most of the people that I speak to, the common thing, and it might be a myth and it may be something we should explore in another show, is that, you know, breaking into private sector is very difficult. If you don't go and play golf, go to school, the kids don't go
or
to school. Or across the board, right?
Well, isn't there a lesson for all of us in this? Mm. So, if you're in a position of power and privilege that you reach out beyond ascriptive similarities with yourself, that you break things like gender lines of association, that you, so it's not some boys golfing club that you, or hunting club or whatever boys do together, that you don't have to belong to the shul to crack a nod, or the church or the mosque or the temple, that you can see in me or the other an intellectual capability that transcends what I look like.
But how far are we? I mean, in reality, is that, are we anywhere close to achieving that?
We're embarrassingly at the foothills after the promise. This is the interesting thing with our country. I think we move in periods of jolts and long periods of stasis. And I think we're experiencing a jolt at the moment to our national consciousness. We cannot call out this kind of behavior when at home, in our own organizations, we behave in an ascriptively prejudicial fashion.
I mean, if you look at where we, so obviously at the heart of this particular saga is government and private sector, but it could easily be private sector and private sector to the extent that we are saying that the whole problem with what we're seeing with Trillion and so on is that the laws of fairness have seemed to be broken in certain instances. People who deserve to be there have been removed for people who don't. But and you spoke earlier about getting the weaker people to get the jobs, and so it actually ends up being bad for society as a whole because you don't have your strongest horses running for you. But private sector does the same in the sense that it only draws from a narrow pool of white and doesn't look beyond that, where you might actually have better skills in the black space. Is that, you know, what is it going to take, and what does a black business then do if that avenue is closed and the government business door is closed because of the likes of the Guptas?
I think we're seeing a rewriting of the rules of the game. I genuinely am seeing an opening of doors. I think folks are looking at themselves in the mirror and saying, well, we can't call out these practices if we're not doing right by society, by black business in general. So I'm hopeful. I think established business is going to see in this an opportunity for more productive engagement practices with black business.
I'm interested in taking this to more of a personal perspective. You know, I think when we read all these stories, and you know, Lord knows most of us are chut full of them, right? When you see the Sunday Times again with a Gupta, a Lynn Brown giving tenders to, you know, partners, friends, and blah blah blah, it almost you almost become desensitized to it, right? And these numbers are so big that you almost think, well, as the average layman or laywoman in South Africa, you're like, well, this is never going to happen to me. I'm never going to get involved in a deal like this. I'm squeaky clean. Let's bring it down into the personal space right now, because I think the ethics needle has drastically shifted and moved. You know the likes in the states of Trump lying, and then everyone going, well, if he's lying, then it's okay for me to do my little white lies because they're not as bad as Trump's lies, right? How do we bring this to the average South African, and how to be moral in this, or how to be good, as we spoke about, in this kind of day and age of everyone around us seeming to just be pillaging and robbing and distorting the idea of what right is?
Let me maybe just jump in on that as well to say that is probably the easier answer. I think the more difficult answer is how we define morality and ethics within a country where the past dictated that you broke the rules and you were doing what was right. And now you're trying to change your mindset for people to say, no, the system mustn't be broken now. But we succeeded as a nation, and our most recent memory of success as a nation is by going against the rules. And so how do we come to a common definition, particularly in an environment where, again, I'm a black business, I'm trying to do things the right way, but that white business is thriving irrespective, irrespective of the fact that we have better skills, that we've been working harder and so on. So basically egalitarianism is thrown out the window. So why in the world, you know, should I continue to, and eventually I begin to see my relationship with the Guptas as nothing more than simply being competitive. And so I throw out the idea of morals in a certain way, and I begin to see it as, well, if they're doing it, then I might as
well
do it.
Eat, right?
And so the definition of morals is also changed. So how do we even come to a common definition of morals and ethics?
I think we're going to need a whole new social compact. You know, as I said, Letsema is not entitled noise any individual business to any custom by any customer. You design your competency and you go to market and you win or lose. What I think there are bigger problems that we have in this country, which is that we're just not getting to the problems of poverty and inequality. And quite frankly, I think, and all thinking South Africans recognize this, that all resources, all our intellect, our common purpose should be designed around how we solve those far more fundamental challenges, and we all slot in behind that goal. Now, what that I think means is that we're all going to have to make sacrifices for future generations, that we treat our privilege with the respect it deserves and the obligation and sense of duty that it deserves, and that we all play by a fair set of rules with respect for the other.
But what's the guiding principle, Derek? I mean, like, you know, I've had a few conversations or been in a few conversations with people from the likes of KPMG, SAP, and McKinsey, right? And they're going, well, what must I do? I'm not the head. I'm not the managers. I'm just an employee. And I want to see this storm through because I'm now being loyal to my company. What must now can to happen?
Everyone has voice, right? From the lowest in the land to the highest, that in these organizations call out bad practices, call out practices that are at odds with the national set of morals that we would all like to see everyone behaving towards. Regardless of the aberrant nature of this particular set of behaviors, we've got far bigger problems. If we don't all start rowing in the same direction and have respect for the limited fiscal resources at our disposal and start thinking about how we consume in South Africa and what we consume and how we share and don't share, we're going to land ourselves in a huge mess, and we will have given up on the promise of 94.
In all fairness though, Derek, this what you've just said could come from the mouth of any of the private sector CEOs. It could come from government. Jacob Zuma Jacob Zuma tends to say the same things. Malusi Gigaba would say the same thing. And they all say it without a sense of irony. So it seems everyone knows the script. Mm-hmm. But to refer to biblical, we know what the word, but it's difficult for the word to become flesh. And it's so what is it actually going to take practically for the word to become flesh in this instance?
We're gonna have to subject our sense of what we all need to consume and what we're entitled to in favor of the other. So let's just think about some of the practical applications of this so it doesn't sound all wishy-washy. Mm-hmm. Well, for one, if you're a business owner, black or white, what are you investing in skills development? How are you spending your profits? Are you reinvesting it in things that are socially productive, in a new piece of lab equipment, in a new piece of of machinery, or a third or fourth house somewhere
in Plate,
wherever, or externalizing the capital, right? There are simple decisions that we can all make to enhance the quality of life of all South Africans and ensure genuinely a better life for all of us.
Mm. It raises the question of, I mean, bringing it back to Letsema. We're seeing a lot of now whistleblowers come out. I mean, the recent one is probably like Trillion. Was she the CEO of Trillion that has now come out and is now being seen as a hero because she's now blowing the whistle and is coming clean? One can say Letsema was quiet all this time, and now we're hearing it speak out. Again, you know, when you say you should speak out, when should you speak out? How should you speak out? I mean, these things happened so many years ago, we're only really hearing the stories now, when there were so many people, the very same people who are blowing the whistle now could have blown the whistle back then. So practically speaking, what is it that kept them quiet then? And what is it that, you know, that it would possibly then keep somebody quiet now that would prevent them from speaking out?
Look, there's clearly a role for speaking out and for people to be brave. And I'm amazed at ordinary South Africans who are choosing an heroic path, and congratulations to them, and our collective thanks to them. But speaking out is one part of a much broader set of activities that I'm making reference to. Mm. I'm saying you need a whole philosophy on what it means to be a privileged South African.
Mm. You know, if I may be the white dude in the room for 1 second and ask, is that not a historical statement? You know, because I think one of the things that for me is a concern, right, is that could it not be seen as black people's role, not role, but black people's comment to that will be like, dude, we've come from apartheid. We've just made it. We just made it. And now you're telling me now, because I'm a little bit privileged, because I'm a little bit middle class, you know, I've just made it into those echelons that I've always seen as typically white. Now you're saying that now we need to change the rules so that we can give back. Like, for who? For what? I've just made it here. I've been against the system the whole time. Life has been against me, my family for hundreds of years, right? And I really say this with respect as being a white male in this room, right? Surely this is part of the problem, right? It's because why must we give up anything if we are black and we've just made it into middle class? Or can we even afford to give up anything because we have black tax and, you know? Again, asking the questions, not trying to sound preachy about it.
If we all don't get onto the bus together, statistically speaking, no matter how much you take from white South Africans, you don't have an equation that balances out. So we all... You know, we're all going to have to think about this thing intergenerationally. And by this thing, I mean how we create a modern industrial state out of the ashes of apartheid, which was the worst possible form of organizing a society. To those architects, if I could speak through time, it was just stupid.
It's you know what I'm busy going through at the moment, Andrew, is this idea of distraction, and how it's so easy in the South African context to be distracted, and there's a long story behind that I'll share next time. Where it's like, you know, South Africans easily get distracted, right? You have one altercation between a black and white person, and the entire country's focus is removed from the bigger project of building our country, and we're now focused on these two people, and now it obviously gets us moving going again, and now we hate white people, we hate black people, and I'm guilty of getting distracted and having been distracted for so often. And I think what the challenge is, I think even as a black person, that I'm beginning to deal with is how often I get distracted from the bigger vision of building a country because I am trying to make sure that white people pay. And it's almost as if I'm going to have to set aside some of the unfairness of what needs to happen in order for the greater good to be achieved, i.e. I might have to tone down on my the way I engage with white people in order for them to walk the journey with me towards the greater good, which is to make sure that the future generations don't have to go through what we went through.
That is so difficult.
That's what Mandela did, right? I spent 27 years, I did this. All of you guys should be basically paying with blood. I'm going to put all of that aside, not because I am unjust to feel that way, but because my focus is on something much bigger than...
But you can imagine young, angry black generation, Rory, going, our parents, our grandparents gave you an olive branch, white people. You now took that olive branch and you literally threw it down in the mud and said, you know, we're just going to carry on as per usual. So you were talking about out of the ashes of apartheid. I think a lot of people are saying, well, actually, are we out of the ashes of apartheid? You know, like apartheid still exists in a lot of constructs in this country. So I agree with you, Rory. Like, I'm the kind of person that's like, we need to build this together as South Africans, not just as black or white. But the truth is, can we really get there? Are we surprised by these business deals and this corruption when a lot of us are going, maybe we just need to burn a whole bunch of stuff, you know?
So I'm pragmatic about this stuff. I believe that there's an opportunity for redemption at every turn. That if you were a sinner yesterday, there's an opportunity to be less sinful today. That if you were a rentier capitalist yesterday, well, take your gains and convert it into productive investment today. If you didn't train your workers yesterday, train them today. If you were thinking of cheating on your taxes, don't do it. Optimize by all accounts, but think how you can spend that money in pursuit of innovation and a greater productive economy in South Africa tomorrow.
And on that note, Andrew, what are you going to do tomorrow that you're not doing today?
No, me, I'm fighting still. Me, I'm still a socialist roaring like you. Have I ever said that I'm a socialist? Jeepers.
Please don't burn anything, Andrew. It's really not your style.
Listen, you're absolutely right. Derek, it has been an absolute pleasure, and thank you for your time joining us on the show. I think we covered a number of topics. I don't even know if we carried our topic through, but I think it was a rich conversation nonetheless. And I appreciate your time, and I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I wish you all the best. And I hope that we are human-centric, even as a consulting firm, and get more human-centric as we go. Rory?
Hey, him and his buzzwords, human-centric. Okay.
Rory, the topic was, frankly speaking, do good people come last? How you feel about that, Rory?
I don't know. I think it's we need to continue the conversation some more. But I think good guys do finish last if they don't box smart.
And on that note, I'd like to quote Marx as beautifully as our friend Derek Letsema from Letsema did. The rich will do anything for the poor, but get off their backs. Thank you so much for listening.
Is that even Marx? Or are you just
lovely,
saying it just because?
Day. That's Marx.
So you do it right at the end of the
Marx.
Show, so we can't actually interrupt.
I have no opportunity to come back.
Exactly. That's what happens when it's called broadcaster privilege. Thank you so much for listening to the show. If you missed any of it, cliffcentral.com/frankly speaking. We'll see you again next week. Ciao, ciao.
This is cliffcentral.com.